accession number 21877, rule 7.
Jim Cramer, Real 7.
As I say, 6 days a week, they might be perfectly all right, but if they got a bit of a skinful of liquor, the differences would come to the fore, especially on St. Patrick's Day. Now, at Bulford Camp one St. Patrick's Day, I was sitting with my friend, Regimental Sergeant Major Bill Kernahan, idly drinking. And we heard the sound of fighting outside, and the sound of arguing in a corner over religion. The Catholics are called Fenians by the Protestants, and the Protestants are called Irishmen by the Catholics. And I said to Bill Cronin, "Do you know, Bill, I can't understand this religious situation." I said, "In 9 times out of 10, they're perfectly all right, great friends, go out drinking together. But when the subject of religion crops up, there's trouble. So if you'd excuse the Anglo-Saxon, but I've got to report, the RSM said, why don't you mind your own fucking business, Cramer?" Which shook me. He never spoke to me for a few weeks after that. But that's the strange situation. They're ever so friendly, a wonderful fighting spirit, no problem at all. And yet this silly religious problem keeps cropping up and spoiling, you know, their standard of life and everything.
What was the RSM? Was he an Orangeman or
a thing? Orangeman. And the QM, the quartermaster lieutenant, lieutenant, he was a Catholic. The half of the cooking staff were Catholic, the other half were Protestant. Now, on the subject of the quartermaster, not his name, Smith. At the end of the war, when we were gathering the convoy together of German people fleeing the Russians, there was a very long tarpaulin-covered vehicle in the field where we were gathering the people. And I heard the sound of screaming. And I went round to find out what was wrong. And two or three of the very young soldiers, I don't know whether they're the ex-70th Battalion boys, came out of this tarpaulin-covered vehicle, looking shamefaced. And from what I gathered, they were forcing themselves onto a young girl in the van, in the lorry, because the mother was most upset. And I was told quite peremptorily by the QM not to stir it up and not to make such a fuss about it, which shook me. So raping apparently went on sometimes if you didn't watch it.
There's something else you told me off the record earlier on, which we haven't put on the record, and that was about joining up at the beginning of the First World War as compared with joining up at the beginning of the Second World War.
Yeah. When in 1939, when war was imminent, there were great arrangements made to recruit a large number of workers for ARP, Air Raid Precautions. And there are lots of application forms which we typed out and cyclone-styled for special constables, rescue workers, and then there's war damage workmen, police messengers for involving young boys, auxiliary fire service, and so on, and wardens. And I was amazed as a young man to see the amount of people of my own age, in the 20s and younger, pouring in to collect application forms. Because in the First World War, I remember from my reading, the recruiting officers were absolutely jammed with young men trying to join the army, the navy, in order to have a go, to have a fight. But not this time. And I have the impression from the papers of that time that the nation as a whole weren't completely happy with a state of war being declared, and there's a hope that Chamberlain would get us out of it. But once the cast had been made, I was surprised that the recruiting officers weren't jammed. Although, of course, in the case of 1939, the recruiting officers were jammed in September, October as well, as I couldn't get in the army before November. But it struck me the attitude had changed, mainly because of the terrible stories from the First World War and the carnage that went on. But it's signs that England wasn't quite so belligerent as it used to be. This isn't always a bad thing, be belligerent.
You're mentioning Bugle and Maguire. I think you've got something to add about him in Normandy.
Yeah, I mentioned earlier on about dear Nicky Maguire. And the reason for the affection is the fact that he was attached to a patrol I was leading about a week or so after D-Day, where we had to establish whether a particular copse a few hundred yards to our front was occupied by the Germans at night. So I took them, about seven or eight men, including Nicky, out, very, very dark, no stars or anything, no moon. We crept along the hedgerows towards where we could crawl closer to the edge of the copse. And there was a gap there, the very lights going up from the German side. The Germans were very, very jumpy at night. And the main reason is, and I haven't mentioned it before, that the Germans were awake all night. We weren't. We were awake during the day and tried to sleep at night with just outposts out to warn of any encroachments by patrol. But the Germans did all their digging at night. They did all their collecting all the food and ammunition and stores, collect that by night, because you could hear the rattle nearly all night long, and sometimes the hooves of horses and the metal-shod wheels, the wagons, bringing up supplies at night. So the Germans, as I say, were always active, putting up these very lights all the time, parachute flares and so forth. But you always heard the pop as they fired it. So you pop, you either froze or you threw yourself to the ground quickly. So after lots of this, there's a bit of a quiet period. So I whispered to them, we cross that gap now. So two or three went across, then I went across, and three or four others went across. And as the last group went across, there's a burst of machine gun fire from the German position in the copse. And you could see the tracer. The tracer saved a lot of lives, because you could see the tracer, you knew not to go anywhere near it. And then we never heard anything, so I led the patrol on. Then when we got back, there were three missing. And I reported them missing. And I suppose I should have, we didn't like to mess around there, because all the hedgerows being peppered, and it didn't pay to hang around there. So I got back, and then I was told to go back that night to check if the bodies were there, which I thought was rather silly, because that meant there'd have been more bodies left for somebody else to pick up. So I led them back into the general area, but I couldn't find anything. I couldn't even find the gap we went across, and brought back, and said that we couldn't find anything. I forgot to tell you, when I came back, I came back about 100 yards further up the lines. Holt, who goes there? Then I gave the password and they let us go in. And the sergeant said, you're a bloody fool. I said, why? He said, you walked right across that bloody minefield. You know, that minefield that our people had put in. But I never saw or heard anything. So that was it. And of course, Nicky Maguire was one of them, which is why I've always felt sorry about it.
Has he got a grave in Normandy?
Hmm?
Has he got?
That's one of the first graves I look for in the airborne forces, the airborne cemetery, war cemetery in Ranville. First place I looked, there he was. I realised he, you know, always thought he was an old man, but he's about 30, I think. How old was I then? I was 29.
You were also telling me earlier about the positioning of German machine guns in the hedges.
Oh, yeah. When Nicky McGuire was hit, he was hit by a German firing on a fixed line because they looked to their front and saw all these noticeable places where an enemy might come. And the same with their old Vickers machine gun. They used devices for indirect fire. So they pointed the barrel of the gun at a gap in the hedge and then took the measurement on the clinometer and then switched round so there's a dial pointing towards the nearby marker. It's a kind of target on a rod of wood, like a stump. So that when you looked through the marker and picked it up, you knew the barrel was pointing at the place where you wanted the bullets to go. So very good at that. But as I say, tracers saved a lot of lives. The same as in Palestine, you saw the tracers going over the top of the camp, so you knew it was safe. It's supposed to help the aimer, but it helps the enemy sometimes, they say. Or the Germans use all kinds of wonderful devices. With the very light pistol, they fire red, green, yellow, blue, whatever it is, to make different signals. Now, red over green over red means offensive fire. In other words, the artillery to get cracking on their registered points. Or, you know, or red means something else. But not only that, but they use parachute flares through the fairy light pistol. And also, what do you call them? What they used to call them? Fife. I remember I had this beautifully made leather case with about 10 very light cartridges in it, marked with different devices. And one I remember was Fife Patronum, which was whistle ammunition. And when that went off, it made a sound like a shower. You know, like a shower falling. So the people would, you know, dive down if they heard it. They're very, very advanced with their equipment. Very advanced. After the war, I went to the tank museum at Boffington. Have you ever been there?
No.
You've got to go there. When you go there, on one side you see the tanks. First of all, the First World War tanks, where we were well in advance. And then, about 1930, you get an English tank, a British tank. And then 1933, you've got the German tank. And it always looked a very modern thing, the 1933 German tank. And then it went on from then on. They were about 20 years ahead of us in tanks. We never had anything like the Heavy Tiger or the, all those enormous things. And they even had motorcycle tanks. Did you see Looking for Private Ryan?
No.
Didn't say that. But in the last scene, you see a motorcycle on tracks, which you use for rough terrain, like a snowmobile. But they were well in advance, the tank. They were low, they were shaped like that, so the shells would ricochet off them, a very heavy front armour. Whereas at the American tanks, they were very tall and cumbersome, and you couldn't put them hull down anywhere. And when they got hit, they burnt up. They used to call them brew pots. Used to go up in flames at the slightest thing. Which amazed us when the, when we came to Germany and when the pursuit came, the closing stage of the war, we were tank-borne infantry for a time, and we used to ride on the hulls of tanks, making sure you didn't step on the radiators, you know, where all the heat came out. But whenever you came up to a copse and the tank driver didn't know whether there's any anti-tank guns, they used to stop out of vision and they used to send the troops, say, you know, make sure there's no anti-tank gun in that copse, which is a bit unfair, really. Well, they were terrified of brewing up. They burned ever so quickly.